Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week we'll hear about an offering of the San Francisco International Arts Festival. We'll hear about the production of Red Velvet at the San Francisco Playhouse from director Margot Hall. Throughout the hour, I'll be joined by comedian Will Durst to talk about his show, as well as offer some political commentary and maybe suggested theme songs for various candidates, past and present. And I'll have a visit with the great preserver of the great American songbook, Michael Feinstein, who is at his namesake's Feinstein's at the Nico through this weekend. Stay with me. San Francisco International Arts Festival gets underway tonight at Fort Mason, and by the time festivities conclude on June 5th, hundreds of presentations in the performing and visual arts will have been offered. The festival celebrates the arts by bringing together a global community of artists and audiences, represented on the performing front by my first guest, and the organization presents innovative projects that are focused on increasing human awareness and understanding. sfiaf.org for more information about the full festival. Sarah Porter does a solo. Sarah does a show. A solo is the one of the opening performances. Sarah Porter is a multifaceted artist, choreographer, performer, writer, and teacher based in Toronto, and has performed all around the world. In addition to writing short fiction, poetry, and songs found in her stage productions of the last 25 years, Sarah is also a celebrated dance writer, and her writings on contemporary dance have been published in books, journals, and magazines in Canada and throughout the UK. Her commissions include work for Toronto Dance Theatre, with the Toronto Symphony, Autumn Leaf in Toronto, as well as Scotland's National Youth Music Theatre. Sarah Porter, pleasure to welcome you to our airwaves.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thanks for coming down south for a little bit for your show. It's been described as exuberant and kind of a sensual aspect here. Tell us a little bit about your show, Sarah Does a Solo.
Exuberant and sensual. Well, it's a dance. It's primarily a dance show, so there's a sensual aspect in that it's a very body-based performance. It mixes storytelling and some memoir-based, I guess, confessional stuff. It's a kind of funny in sections, and it's a mix of pretty much all the different aspects of my life. I took a bit of a break from performing 6 years, and I wrote a book and had 3 kids. And
that's a break.
That was the break from performing. And, you know, expanded my life focus a little bit. Kids do that. You know, you kind of lose control of what you're paying attention to when you have kids around you.
That's why I have cats.
That cats can be helpful. They don't talk back quite as much, though. You know, herding cats, we talk about that and talk about our kids. So the show is a really diverse mix of all these different aspects of my life, and some direct address. I've done a fair amount of clown in my background, and it kind of runs the gamut from dark and, I don't know, poignant, people say, and kind of funny, and I change my clothes a lot.
Okay. So what will we see on stage then?
What do you see? Well, you see me for a whole hour in a lot of different costumes. I don't know. What do you see? You see me. James Kendall is traveling with me. He's my tech director, and I have quite a big improv background as well, and we incorporate that into the show. And the reason James travels with me is sometimes I like to change the cues in the middle of the show and mix it up a little bit. It's a little dangerous. Sometimes we're not always sure what's going on.
Living on the edge with
Living
Sarah
on
Porter.
The edge with Sarah.
Well, actually, we're joined in studio by your build as a comedian as well. We're joined in studio by one of the great political comedians here in San Francisco, Will Durst. Hey, Will.
Yo.
Nice to have you with us.
Well, it's an honor to be here. No, I mean, just to hear a 6-year break from performing and she had 3 kids. You're quite mad, young lady.
And I wrote a book.
And you wrote a book.
It's a very serious book.
Was it really?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a biography of one of our Canadian national dance treasures. Actually, he comes from New York. He's a New York Rochester guy. Yeah, a biography of his life. And, you know, my editor, at the end of writing that book, you know, compiling stories, he's in his early 80s now, quite a really crazy guy and really a bit of a... I can't swear on the radio,
no.
Right? He's he has some aggressive aspects to his personality. He's not well-liked by everybody, so it was challenging to write stories about that. When I finished writing the book, my editor said, you know, Sarah, you should write some stories about yourself. And I thought, oh, no, man, I don't do that. But I actually, you know, I just went to the pub, and I thought, well, maybe it's not a bad idea. So I made these teeny little short stories. I was reading Lydia Davis, you know, this New York writer who, she can get a short story into like two sentences. So I took that as a challenge. I thought, how short can I make a story? And there you go. There are those.
So this is for two performances only.
Yeah.
Has it been performed up in the Great White North as well?
The Great White North. And we're pretty much east of you guys, actually, not that much south. But yeah, it's had a good run. So I've kind of been 2 years in the making. I've done a couple of Toronto performances of earlier versions. I've been to New York twice so far, and I've got one more gig down there at the Flea Theater. Yeah, we've been to Montreal a couple weeks ago, New York a month ago, and I've got five more Canadian dates coming up.
Great.
Yeah.
It's also billed as, you know, it's a part autobiography, right? So you're putting some of your very essence on the line.
Well, it's funny because, you know, people say that thing about it being quite a personal show. There's some memoir-based stuff in it, but I really play with that edge of whether I'm lying to you or not.
Yeah.
And I've been reading, actually there was an article in The Guardian like the other day about the English language divides writing into fiction and nonfiction. And you go in the bookstore and there's like two sides to the bookstore. But this article is about in all these different languages. That divide is not made between fiction and nonfiction. Writing is writing and stories are stories. And I really play in that place. So it's personal in that, you know, often dance is a very formal art form and we don't talk to the audience. It's structurally formal. It has a whole reserve to it sometimes because it's often about shape and space, and I break that down and I talk to the audience, and I mean, there's an acting element. It seems personal, but I play with that.
So I'm curious how, you know, you're weaving an awful lot of things in here.
Yeah, it's a lot of things.
Dancing and storytelling. Is it like, okay, and now I'm going to dance for you? How are you weaving it all together?
I don't know, man. Come see the show.
Give it away.
I don't know. I have two great people that I work with in Toronto, a director and a rehearsal assistant, and we just compile stuff. There is a thread that moves through it. There's a great Canadian, well, she's kind of world-renowned singer-songwriter, Mary Margaret O'Hara. I don't know if your listeners would know her, but she, I did a gig with her one night, just kind of improv at a party, and that forms the basis, really, of the story of my coming out of early retirement from performing. That makes a thread throughout the piece, and it's a bit imagistic, the show. Yeah, it swings around. It's a little surprising at times, so they say.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. And part of this wonderful International Arts Festival here in San Francisco. Have you been down to perform with us before here in town?
I have never been to San Francisco.
Oh, my gosh.
My partner is from Vancouver, so we've been out that way and driven down the coast, and I flew to L.A. once and drove up the coast, but I missed this section.
How bizarre is that?
I know. Well, I was very sad, too, so I'm thrilled to be here.
Can you have some little downtime then, I hope?
We're here for the better part of a week. Yeah, two shows with a little bit of space around them. So.
Well, that sounds great.
Beautiful city.
Perfect. Sarah Porter. Sarah does a solo, celebrated Canadian dancer, performing artist, and comedian as part of the 2016 San Francisco International Arts Festival. Two performances only on the 20th and the 22nd. That's this Friday at 8 and Sunday evening at 7. Information at sfiaf.org/dance. Sarah, have a wonderful stay here, and would love to hear your impressions of San Francisco next time you visit.
Thank you very much.
Will Durst is staying in studio to talk a little bit about the whole KALW story, as well as talk about your own show that's coming up. Will, you have been a fan of public radio for many of these years.
Now. Many years, many. But not since 1941, which was when KALW was the first FM station in the Bay Area. And I'm trying to figure out what KALW stands for.
Oh, we could think of all kinds of things on that one.
No, because in the beginning, they were all acronyms. They all,
oh, right, right.
WGN was the world's greatest newspaper, and WLS was the world's largest store. It was sponsored by Sears. So, and I think KGO and KNBR, and I think all those had acronyms for something.
Well, I know what we stand for at KLW. But what KLW stands for is another question. We stand for community involvement in the arts in this hour especially. And if you want to support that effort of what we do for local artists and performers, I encourage you to give a call to 800-525-9917 or make a pledge online by clicking the donate button at klw.org.
Yeah. 800-525-9917.
Well, you got a show, ongoing show at the Marsh.
Well, I've been doing previews, and so the press opening is on Tuesday, May 24th, and it's Elect to Laugh 2016. And unfortunately, you know, just haven't had any grist for the comedic mill this year. So it's been a slog. It's been hard actually coming up with material. No, it's like slam dunking from a stepladder.
Oh,
it really
my gosh,
is.
Yeah.
It's stealing candy from a blind baby on roofies. It's rip and read almost. I mean, they just every day there's something different. Hmm. And I'll be doing this every Tuesday until the election. So
nice.
But come out on Tuesday because I think some press might show up and I need people to laugh. So go to themarsh.org and check out Will Durst. And if you use the super secret code VOTE, you get $10 off a ticket.
Very nice.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's good.
Well, I thought I'd have you on to co-host and help shill for KLW as well as think
about... You always get me on during these pledge things, and I always feel a little sullied, you know.
Nonsense. One of the premises I thought would be fun to riff on a little bit is theme songs for candidates, past and present. One tune that I didn't realize had words. Here's one that has words that I had no idea. Let me see if I can find it here. Something very familiar to us all, more as a march. But check out these words.
I did not know that. Who wrote this, do we know?
It says James Sanderson, but I'm not sure.
I don't know who Sanderson is.
You always hear, you know, the...
Hail to the Chief.
Instrumental version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You never hear the words.
No, it gets in the way.
Well, I always thought that the contemporary candidates are ripe for some creative theme songs. Like, who would we choose for someone like Rick Perry?
Oh, wow. Well, it'd have to be ZZ Top. I would say Sharp Dressed Man.
He still wants that theme to play for him. No, Rick. It's not going to happen. In fact, I was thinking of this for Rick.
Confirmed with the flowers. And the rain. And my head, I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain.
Poor Rick Perry.
Of course, that could have been, you know, for Sarah Palin as well.
Or Michelle Bachman. Or there's the list goes on and on and on. Yeah.
Well,
maybe even John Edwards. I think we might be able to throw a Democrat in there,
well,
too.
Well, I mean, it's different between having a brain and just being stupid about something.
That's a fine distinction there, Mr. Yeah. Latulippe.
Well, campaign songs have always had a very important role in a candidate's campaign.
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
But recognizable, you know, I mean, just a touchstone.
Rally the troops.
Yes. And, for instance, you know, high hopes for JFK and because of his close association with Frank Sinatra. So there was that kind of a thing that they all, you know, JFK was kind of an adjacent member of the Rat Pack.
Oh, we happen to have High Hopes nearby as a little sample. Let's have a listen. This was recorded in a special version for JFK.
Yes, yes.
Next time you're found with your chin on the ground, there's a lot to be learned. So look around.
Just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows an ant can't move around.
rubber tree plant, but he's got heart.
And then, of course, Frank recorded a special version
for JFK.
For JFK, putting it into the lyrics. Just
This one is so surrealistic. How would an ant move a rubber tree plant? Really, that's the opening line of the song? Everybody knows that an ant can't move a rubber tree? Does everybody really know that? I don't think they ruminate.
There's got to be some kind of backstory to that. Maybe we don't know what's happening before the high hopes are actually
perhaps you're right. Maybe it's part
after.
Of a musical or something, yeah.
Well, let's see. Who else we have in the candidate front for this season that might...
My favorite. Can I bring up my favorite?
Please.
My favorite was Ross Perot.
I got a chart.
That's right. Ross Perot. The giant sucking sound. his campaign theme song was actually Crazy by Patsy Cline.
Really?
Yes.
That's hard to believe.
And Nils, oh, you're a genius. Yes.
Crazy. Ross Perot, no doubt.
Because they called him crazy, and he just, it's like being called a cheesehead. Us Wisconsinites just grabbed onto it.
I remember my favorite line was that, like, no one wants to talk about the deficit. It's like some crazy aunt you got to keep in the basement. No one wants to look at her or talk to her.
That's a good Ross Perot,
I was just going to vote for him just for that.
Remember, he got out of the race because the CIA was going to disrupt his daughter's wedding. Remember that?
No.
It's a Texas wedding. How do you disrupt a Texas wedding?
Unbelievable. Let's see. I thought that perhaps for Hillary, what would we do for Hillary?
There's so much. I think she, for a while, she was using Taking Care of Business by Bachman Turner Overdrive. And Beautiful Day by U2. I think she used Beautiful Day by U2 for a while.
Well,
not sure.
Well, as we know, she's got a lot in her past that is going to come out. So I maybe thought this from young folks would work for her.
If I told you things I did before, told you how you
dredging up Hillary's past just might work for that.
What is this?
It's a tune called Young Folks. Don't care about the young folks.
By who?
Is
this Foster the People?
No, it's Peter, Bjorn, and John.
Peter, Bjorn, and John?
Yeah, it's a great tune.
Wow.
Yeah. Dredging into Hillary's past. Oh, well, maybe not a home run for me.
Well, I don't know the song, but otherwise.
And then there's... let's see, who else could we skewer here? Who in the past had a really memorable?
Well, there were George H.W. Bush tried to use Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen, and Bruce objected. And I think somebody tried using Tom Petty, and he objected, and somebody tried using U2, and he objected. I think Tom Petty, American Girl, I think that was Michelle Bachman, and he objected to Michelle Bachman using it. It's funny when you can't pick a song by a group that is so antithetical to your, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this one I thought for Jeb. Or maybe Bernie.
A dream, the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe.
Yeah, I don't know if that would work for Bernie. Bernie's using America by Simon and Garfunkel.
Ah. That's a good one for Bernie, I think, America.
Went out looking for America. Yeah.
Except for the toss me the cigarettes line. I don't know. I'm going to go for that one.
His bow tie was actually a camera, something like that.
I've got some real estate here in my bag.
So how do you... how do you sift through all of this material to come up with a show, given that it's just like falling in your lap?
You're right, David. The hard part is not writing the material. It's figuring out where to put it and what to get rid of in order to replace it, because, otherwise it would be 3 hours long. So every week there's something, every week. And Donald Trump, the guy he's a force of nature. And even I see liberals, who say, I know he's way off the charts, but he's got a point here and there. Wow, shut up. No, not even a jest. It's a little frightening.
Mm. Well, we'll have more with Will Durst as the hour continues. Thanks, Will. We'll chat in just a minute. I've got a couple other segments I'd like to introduce. Cool. One is a wonderful conversation I had at Feinstein's at the Nikko with the namesake, not Dianne Feinstein, but Michael Feinstein. But let's hear some of his wonderful singing, and then we'll have that re-recorded interview. This is Isn't It Romantic?
I've never met you, yet never doubt, dear. I can't forget you. I've thought you out, dear. I know your profile and I know the way you kiss. Just the thing I miss on a night like this. If dreams are made of imagination, I'm not afraid of my own creation. With all my heart is here for you to take. Why should I quake? I'm not awake. Isn't it romantic? Music in the night. A dream that can be heard. Isn't it romantic? Moving shadows right. The oldest magic world. I hear the breezes playing in the trees. Such a night as this, isn't it romantic? Every note that's sung is like a lover's kiss. Sweet symbols in the moonlight, do you
Michael Feinstein, so lovely to be in your own space here at the Nikko with you.
I'm very glad to be with you.
Have you fully mined the Ira Gershwin treasure trove, or is there more to discover?
There's more. There's always more of all of this. I would say that there aren't any extraordinary songs that haven't been heard in some way or that I haven't found, but there are lyrics of his that are interesting. And it would be fun to set some of them to music. There are little bits and pieces. There are a lot of melodies of George Gershwin's that haven't seen the light of day. And some of the brilliant things that Ira wrote were things that were cut from shows, so they don't stand outside of the context of the thing for which they were created.
Did you discover some of this that you'd like to explore more at the Gershwin's place or through the wonderful stuff that you found in the Warner Brothers warehouse that they were about to get rid of?
It's a combination. During the time I was working for Ira is when the Warner Brothers, this cache of material turned up in the Warner Brothers music warehouse. That was 1982. And it was such a momentous find of musical theater treasures that it warranted a story on the front page of the New York Times, because it was, I don't know how many boxes of manuscripts of everyone from Noel Coward to Victor Herbert to Leonard Bernstein to the Gershwins and Arthur Schwartz, Richard Rodgers, Cole Porter, Vincent Humans. It was extraordinary. And so a number of things turned up then that we considered to be lost, including the entire score of the show Pardon My English, which was lost. The whole thing turned up there, all the orchestrations, everything. It was amazing.
I imagine the regret you must feel of not having gotten to the MGM archive in time.
Oh, the MGM archive. That's one of the tragic stories of Hollywood. And I think about that a lot because I spend time now trying to find orchestrations because I'm now conducting. I'm conducting an orchestra in Pasadena and one in Palm Beach, and a couple of others are in the offing. And I try and find arrangements by names that are not known to the public but very important, like Skip Martin, who did all these swing charts at MGM and was Fred Astaire's favorite jazz arranger, and Conrad Salinger, who was the lush string writer for MGM, and Herbert Spencer, and I mean, the list goes on and on, and so much of it is destroyed, and I can't fathom how these things could be destroyed, but it's tragic.
So the Sinatra Project, reintroducing us to the great Harry Warren and Johnny Mercer tunes. Who's next that we're going to be treated to in a Michael Feinstein fashion?
I've spoken to David Shire about doing an album of his songs with the composer at the piano. I think that would be wonderful. There are so many things that I want to get to. I want to do an album of the songs of Johnny Green. Johnny Green was a dear friend and is known for, died in 1989. He's known for Body and Soul and I Cover the Waterfront and Easy Come, Easy Go, That's the Way of Love Must Have Its Day. But great, great songs. So it's endless. I think I just want to start preserving, recording these things and preserving them and just putting them out there so people will have a reference to be able to hear some of this stuff.
It was so wonderful to see you on YouTube singing with the late, great Rosemary Clooney, who we lost in 2002. Now, could George Clooney ask for a more wonderful aunt or not?
I met George when he first came to Hollywood. He was staying with Rosemary, staying off the kitchen in the maid's closet. And I still can't wrap my brain around what he's become, because he was just kind of irritating at that time. He's a very nice guy, so don't get me wrong, and we always have warm reunions, but it's still kind of funny.
And Rosemary was a neighbor of Gershwin's.
Rosemary lived next door to Ira Gershwin. She and her husband Jose Ferrer bought a house in the 50s that was at one time occupied by George and Ira Gershwin in the 30s, and then the house was occupied by a famous singer named Ginny Sims, who was a big star at one time. But yeah, Rosemary lived next door to Ira for 30 years, and I got to meet her because of one of her cats going astray and coming over to the Gershwin house, and it gave me an introduction to her, so I'm grateful for that.
And that wonderful tune you were singing with her, Our Love Is Here to Stay, was it, or on that video?
But could have been that, or could have been They Can't Take That Away From Me. Rosemary particularly loved Ira Gershwin's lyrics and, of course, George's music. And we performed through the years after I met her about 200 shows together.
Speaking of YouTube, in one of your videos you mentioned how the era of the Gershwins and the Great American Songbook was a time when almost every home in America had a piano or dreamed of having one, where that big black box was the center of music making. And then there was the three TV network era that you and I grew up in. Now, most schools, let alone homes, have little, if any, music making. Either that or it's specialized, but still far from universal. And we have hundreds of entertainment channels to choose from, the touch of a button, not to mention the internet. Are we in danger of losing this kind of direct music making, or are we just maybe evolving differently?
Oh, we've already lost it. We've already lost direct music making. I don't know that technology is bad today. I think it's wonderful in so many ways. However, the irony, or the I guess it's irony that there are so many more possibilities, so many more ways that young people can get music, but a majority of them are limited in what they're listening to. Yet I meet a lot of young people who are interested in all kinds of music, who have very eclectic tastes, who are led to it one way or another, or just discover it. And that's why I started the Great American Songbook Foundation, to help high school kids with that. But when I wanted to find a recording of Ethel Waters singing Porgy, she made two records of it. If I want to find her 1928 record of it, it could take years. I mean, it was a search. So I built up my collection the hard way, the old-fashioned way. And now it's so damn easy.
Well, that's one of the ways you're keeping this wonderful legacy of the songbook going, is through this foundation you established back in 2007, and summer intensive courses that are open to students around the country. And you're meeting young people all the time through either cast of Glee or however through the institution. Did you ever think, working as Ira's archivist back when you were 20 years old or so, that you would subsequently perform and associate with some of the most iconic performers and voices of the 20th century?
The short answer is no. I was very grateful to get a job playing in a piano bar. And as things evolved, it was pretty amazing. I still look back at it with amazement, because I'm not properly schooled musically, and it didn't seem like I had much of a chance of moving out of a piano bar. So to have been able to perform with so many legends, and just to meet so many of these people, still is overwhelming when I think about it.
I might add, adding your own name now to those that are continuing this great tradition of keeping the songbook alive, you're going to be in that pantheon as well. You mentioned that you're also delving now into the conducting front, leading the Pasadena Pops and no doubt some other groups. Something you've always wanted to do?
I never wanted to conduct. I mean, I thought about it, but never seriously, because it's such a difficult thing to do. And yet I was sort of not forced into it, because I did agree to do it. But Marvin Hamlisch passed away right after I'd worked with him at the Pasadena Pops. It was his very last concert. And they asked me if I would assume his post, his conducting post, and I said, I don't do that. But I was persuaded to try it. But in order to try it, I had to rehearse with an orchestra, so I had to hire an orchestra, which I did. I hired an orchestra for 3 days in Seattle and practiced. And I didn't know till the first night, till the first concert, if I would even be able to get through it with any alacrity. Is that the right word? Anyway, it turned out all right, but I must say that going into my fourth season now doing it, I'm a lot better than I was when I started, because it's a lifetime journey, forgive the word, to get the technique, as well as the even harder part, which is the ability to communicate the emotion of what you want to hear.
Well, any more of your own composing down the road? You wrote some original music for Get Bruce, the fun documentary about Bruce Valanche back in 1999. Writer, fixer, comedian Bruce Valanche. More recent collaboration with Maya Angelou on We Dream These Dreams. Anything more on that front coming your way?
I just wrote a song with John Buchino. We wrote a song that was commissioned by Carnegie Hall for their 125th anniversary, which we performed together there. I wrote a song with Mark Cherry, the creator of Desperate Housewives, for the Terrence McNally show that was on Broadway. It's only a play. So I've been writing here and there. I write when the opportunity arises. I wrote a musical that was just workshopped in England, so we'll see what happens with that. So I do write. It's always about choosing what I want to do in the time that I have, and I enjoy writing. And yet the conducting is the thing that's been the most exciting for me lately. But I will continue to write. I will continue to write, because I feel like I have something to express there. I feel like I have...
Michael, you tell a wonderful story about the Gershwins and the unexpected turn that a familiar ballad that we all know and love so well actually started off quite differently.
Yes. George and Ira were working on a show in 1926 called OK, and they always had to supply the requisite ballads, the up-tempo dance numbers, the opening choruses. There was a formula in those days of what they had to supply. And George was working on an up-tempo number that was actually a dance number, and this is the tune he came up with. The idea of it was that it was the cutting off of the phrase. And he was playing the tune for Ira, and as he was playing it, he got distracted, and so he started to slow down, and this is what had happened. And they realized that this tune would actually be better suited as a ballad. There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. So that's how they came up with the idea for the ballad of the show, Someone to Watch Over Me, which was a tremendous hit. And yet George saved the rhythmic idea and put it into another dance number in the show called Fidgety Feet. I've got fidgety feet, fidgety feet, fidgety feet. So he saved that syncopated idea but just used it in a different way. So nothing went to waste.
Michael Feinstein, great preserver of the great American songbook, at his namesake Feinstein's at the Nico, nicosf.com for more information. He's doing a special tribute to Alan and Marilyn Bergman in these sets. Sounds absolutely wonderful. I heard the show last night, well worth catching out. Let's hear one of his earlier releases as we go out once again with music of Michael Feinstein.
When a girl meets boy, life can be a joy, but the note they end on will depend on little pleasures they will share. So let us compare. Benny's jokes to a degree. I love the common folks, that includes me. I like to window shop on Fifth Avenue. I like banana splits, late supper at the Ritz. How about you? A dream of fame. Maybe I'll shine. I'd love to see your name right beside mine. I can see we're in harmony. Looks like we both agree on what to do. And I like it. How about you?
Michael Feinstein's at the NICO through this weekend. Information at the NICOSF.com website. David LaTulipe here once again with Will Durst, asking for your support for the arts, from Feinstein to the San Francisco Playhouse to the International Arts Festival here in San Francisco. We do just about everything. It's a broad brush we paint with.
I think eclectic is the word. I think you're very eclectic.
It works.
You're also electric, too.
Oh, I imagine. 800-525-9917 during this, our final push, our final day of our 10-day drive for our spring membership. Will, we do things a little differently here for these membership drives. First of all, we only come to people twice a year, which is unheard of in the
public radio
scheme. And then we don't interrupt the programming. I mean, we're just taking a couple of minutes here as a natural chit-chat. But the programs that we get off the bird, so to speak, that we pull down from the satellite, we're keeping everything intact and just taking those natural one-minute breaks, two-minute breaks to ask for your support. And that's also unheard of, and it's working.
And if people go to KALW.org and click the donate button, we could continue to do that rather than shove it in their face and say, please, for hours and hours on end.
Yeah, and people are responding. 800-525-9917. Make this call now. As we continue our arts conversation, I'm David LaTulipe, your host for Open Air, our magazine, radio magazine of the performing arts. And next, I'd like to talk about what's happening at the great house called San Francisco Playhouse. Always innovative things that are going on there. Well, the West Coast premiere of Red Velvet, written by Lolita Chakrabarty, is at the SF Playhouse through June 25th. Carl Lumbly will star as Ira Aldridge, the African-American actor who in the 19th century and against the social mores of the day built an incredible reputation on the stages of London and Europe. The show is directed by Margot Hall, who has had the pleasure of directing and performing for the San Francisco Playhouse. She most recently directed Hamlet, Blood in the Brain for Chabot College, where she is a professor. Welcome, Margot.
Hi.
Did I say Chabot? Is it Chabot?
Chabot.
Yeah. I've always wondered how to say that, right?
Yeah.
Now you've set me straight.
The kids call it Chabot, so it's fine.
I'm sure they have a lot of other things to say.
I'm sure.
So, Margot, tell me about Ira Aldridge.
Well, as you stated, he was a black American actor who left New York as a teenager to pursue a career in London and Britain to perform Shakespeare. And he was pretty successful, and he was the first African American to play Othello on a British stage. And in this particular piece, the main event is a performance at the Covent Garden, where the head of the company, Mr. Keane, has fallen ill, literally fallen on stage. And Pierre Laporte, who is a French producer, brings in Ira Aldridge to replace the famous Mr. Keane. To the company's surprise, he is a black man. And it kind of chronicles this true story of Ira Aldridge coming into a place where he is not accepted. Theater was very inclusive at the time. It makes you question the idea of who owns art, who owns theater. Mm. The idea that it is inclusive and only certain people are capable of doing it well. There's an actor in the play who says that the British are colorless canvases on which to paint, whereas someone who is actually like Ira Aldridge, who is black, or anyone else who is not of that caliber, should not be able to perform. In the play, masterfully played by Carl Lumbly, you get an idea also of the interesting style of acting that was done in Britain at the time, which was what they called teapot acting. This very broad sense of and very loud voices.
Master thespian.
Yes, master thespian acting. And Mr. Aldridge came in with what they called domestic acting, which we would say today maybe method acting, where he comes in and says, no, you have to be real. They didn't even look at each other. They looked straight forward, and they had these big grand gestures. And he asks the lead actress in the company, Ellen Tree, would you look at me? And everyone gasps, oh, no, you can't do that.
Huh.
So there's a bit of humor in the play as well.
So it's interesting. He's not only breaking down the barrier of being a black actor on the proper stage, but actually changing the way we're looking at this, where the audience is to perceive a play.
Right. And it's like, what's real? And does he bring the realness to the story?
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the producers of the event, the board and all of that, they feel like his performance was too real. And so you go into the whole concept of, is it a black man's anger that makes him too real, or is he just being an actor?
Hmm.
So it's a very deep and beautifully, I was going to say beautifully staged, even though I staged it.
Okay. I'm sure it is.
Yes, it is, actually. No, but it's a beautiful play. Bill English, his brother Gary English designed the set, and it is just incredible.
Oh, anything associated with Bill English is going to be a home run. That's great.
Yes.
And of course, Susie D'Amelano there as well.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So when did you first hear about Ira Aldridge?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, it was not until I was in college. And I just ran across it in a book about, it was like an African-American artist's. And I saw this blurb about Ira Aldridge, and I've always wondered about him. And then I taught a class at USF, African American Culture and History, and I learned a little bit more about it. But like Paul Robeson, he was also pretty much stricken from a lot of our history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting, I think, that SF Playhouse is doing this play to bring that story to life. On the first day of rehearsal, I asked everyone in the play, had they ever heard of Ira Aldridge? And no one had. And I thought that was so sad. But at the same time, what a great opportunity, like I said, to introduce him to the community.
Yeah, and introducing through Carl Lumbly. Tell us about Carl.
Well, Carl is great. I've had the opportunity to act with him on stage. I did Fences with him at Marin Theater Company, and also MF with a hat at SF Playhouse. And so it was really great to now be on the other side. We have a really good, genuine relationship as artists, and so it's been a pleasure to see him embrace this character of Ira Aldridge.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the people at the time in the theater weren't responding greatly to his idea of not just declaiming but interacting with the actors. Did we know if he ultimately did have an effect on subsequent theater in London?
You know, I don't know that. I do know that he was taught it as one of the best Shakespearean actors of his time. So whether they changed or not, the audiences really loved what he brought to it. And I'm sure in this particular instance, he does change the lead actress to perform his way, which probably made her more successful, I would assume.
Hmm. It's Margot Hall, who is directing Red Velvet, written by Lolita Chakrabarty. How have you heard of Lolita Chakrabarty before?
I had never heard of her until I heard of this play.
Uh-huh.
I'm really interested in other works. I know that she wrote this for Adrian Lester, who I think is her husband, to give him a vehicle. He is a British actor with the National Theatre of London. And this was written specifically for him. And so far, he has played the Ira Aldridge character in, I think, all of the productions that have been done.
Wow. This play runs through the 25th of June. Information at sfplayhouse.org. The biographical West Coast premiere of Red Velvet by Lolita Chakrabarty, starring Carl Lumbly and directed by Margot Hall. SF Playhouse for more information. Thanks so much for coming in,
Thank
Margot.
Thank you.
Will Durst is standing by at the mic to talk more about why one should lend one support to this local public radio station.
Because if you don't, where are you going to go? You won't be able to listen to this. Yeah, you'll be out in the street. You'll have one of those little begging bowls and sitting in a lotus position.
Well, everyone needs apples and pencils, right?
No.
They don't? No, really?
No.
Damn.
Pencils, yeah. The cup with the pencils, I think, had its time. You know, imagine in the 30s, it was people needed pencils. Now,
you were performing in Germany recently, weren't you?
I was. I did a series of Deutsches Amerikanische Institut gigs around Germany. So we did Cologne and Köln. And we did Nuremberg. And
sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Not at all. I learned that Bauer means farmer, so I would always order the Bauer omelet. But man, they can drink beer. Oh my living God! It's like you're gonna take it away from them. And I actually told them, if beer drinking were an Olympic sport, that Germany would have been disqualified centuries ago for having lost their amateur status. And they would laugh,
waving goodbye, Milt Will to Margo. Bye, Margo. Thanks for coming in. how did those workshops and shows go for you?
Went really well. Got to work with Andy Velver, who used to be here in the Bay Area, and then he works for Deutsche Welle, and he set this series of comedy up. And he actually had because he does this great routine about the European Union being like a dysfunctional family. And he actually did a line, which I lust after, and he said that the American presidency is too important for American voters to decide.
Oh, man.
isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
I'm doing a line similar. I do a line, I don't know what's scarier, the fact that one of these people is going to become president or the American people get to decide.
Yeah, it's something. And then the funny thing is hearing about someone like Jimmy Carter, who's gone around the world to various countries verifying elections and stuff. He said he couldn't do it in this country. He could not. It would be impossible to prove that voting was going on properly in this country because of every state's different rules and different regulations.
Yeah, you couldn't do it.
Amazing.
And it's all, it's just started. California counts for the first time. I think the only reason Bernie is going to stay in the race is because he wants to give all those millions of people in California who gave him $27 or more, and I think he wants to give them a chance to vote for him, and I think that's only fair. Mm. But I don't know if he's helping Hillary I don't know if he's helping defeat Donald Trump.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, the reason why I thought of having these theme songs today for various candidates is because rock group after rock group said, hey, you cannot use my going to have my music associated with you. So what would we choose for a Donald Trump song?
I don't
real
know.
Or imagined?
I would go back to Ross Perot. I would go with Crazy.
Well, I think this one might work. I'm going to need to do some creative editing, but I think this would work for Trump.
Drumpf.
Oops.
I can hear it. I'm not sure if the audience can.
Yeah, let's get this properly here. Back it up a bit. Here we go.
You're a mean one,
Mr. Trump.
You really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
It all works so well when you listen to these words. It's pretty amazing.
He is a black banana with a greasy black peel.
You're a monster,
Mr. Trump.
Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch.
I don't see that as a problem.
I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole.
I think that works for Mr. Trump.
Yes.
Joined now in studio by Matt Martin as well to close out Open Air. Hey, Matt.
Hey, David.
What's the good news from the phone room?
Well, the good news is we've had a lot of people going, especially to KALW.org and given their support. Folks like Lori Polster, who loves Tangents and Cross Currents and Your Call. Also, Joe Arnstein in Lake Bluff saying, I appreciate the engaging in diverse content, the fact he gets to learn something every day. And we heard from Chris Palmer in Pleasanton, who particularly said she appreciated that we support, oh my goodness, live local music, certainly something you get a lot of here on Open Air.
Indeed.
We ask you to join these good folks. Go to KALW.org or make a call at 800-525-9917. This is the day we want to complete this campaign.
Get it over with. Yes. Close the door on it.
800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
800-525-9917. Join the many people who have stepped up during this spring membership campaign. The last day getting towards ticking it down, really. And we're not going to come back to you again until maybe September or so. Right, Matt?
Definitely September. We just do it twice a year, May and September. That's how we do it. Keep it to a minimum as much as we can. Short breaks, 10-day drives. This is day 10. So show your support now. 800-525-9917.
It's the 240th hour.
We don't like to think of that much, but the way Matt's talking, maybe so. He deserves a break later tonight, that's for sure. 800-525-9917. Will Durst, your show is at the Marsh in Workshop, is that correct?
No, it opens on Tuesday. Yes, we're finally premiering a press. So Elect to Laugh 2016. Come on down. It's me for 90 minutes talking about what's going on with an overhead projector, and I show transparencies of all the candidates.
Transparencies?
I do.
Yeah.
It's old school, man. Old school. Yeah. You can't keep up. Why even try?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your coming in and sharing some airtime.
Thanks for having me, man.
Of course, we'll have you again. And maybe during a non-pledge time so we're not put on the spot. WillDurst.com for more information. Also, themarsh.org for more information. Matt, just about 40 seconds to offer the phone number and our website once more before we go to the BBC News.
Well, in time to thank Stephanie Funk in San Francisco and Kenneth Weinberg in Los Altos. They both went to KALW.org. That's what it's about. One person at a time, giving their support, keeping local public radio strong. This is your time. 800-525-9917, KALW.org.
Thanks. We go to the news now from the BBC. This is KALW San Francisco.